And we're back. Thanks for staying tuned to WVFF 97.7 FM and now more true crime in the Lowcountry.
No, what I mean is Alec could sign a confession of judgment for something like $2.6 million. That's the percentage of the total of $4.3 stolen, frankly, that the Satterfields are claiming, bizarrely claiming they're entitled to. I say they're entitled to nothing, but anyway, but it would never have been the full $4.3 million. And you may not know that, and, you know, Frank may not know it, Jim may not know it, but Alec Murdoch knows it. So why did he sign a confession of judgment for an amount, for a total amount that would never, the Satterfields under no circumstance would have gotten the total amount of 4.3. I think Alec was coerced into signing that confession of judgment for 4.3 in exchange for an agreement he had with Eric Bland that Eric wouldn't oppose. Alec at one point wanted his bail reduced. His bail had been set at $7 million. He wanted it reduced. There was a hearing to reduce it, and Eric Bland agreed to not oppose the reduction in that bail if Alec Murdoch would sign this $4.3 million confession of judgment. So I think that that $4.3 million confession of judgment.
What's the timeline? Elaine, what's the timeline here? Mm-hmm. When
the bond reduction hearing was before, I think it was Judge Allison Lee, and I think it was held on January 9th or January 15th. I think it was originally scheduled for the 9th, and it snowed, and so it got carried over to the following Monday or Tuesday. It was a hearing that we all watched online with a Zoom, you know, camera, and it's at that hearing where Dick Hart-Prutlian said we don't need to hear from Alex's victims of his financial abuse because they all sing the same song or something. He was very dismissive about these victims of these financial crimes, although at that point, PMPD is advertising to the world that they had made all these victims whole, that none of them had lost a penny. And so they weren't, they had been swindled, you know, but they had then been made whole. And, you know, we were talking about, Jim's talked about an attorney just this past year that stole basically, I think it's what, $30 million from her clients, and she got 5 years of probation. So, and she didn't pay back anybody. She got 5 years of probation in South Carolina. So, but Alec, I think, was stunned that he didn't get, that the bond wasn't reduced. And then also at that point, Daniel Hall in the 111, the boat crash case, had seized all of Alec and Buster's assets, all of them, all future earnings, all current savings, everything, property, real property, investments, everything. And that was such an outrageous overreach because Daniel Hall is presiding over a civil action related to the boat crash where they haven't gone to trial. They're not in settlement. There's no dollar amount at that point that's even it being bandied about. So without knowing what Alec Murdoch's net assets are, no judge could have, I'm surprised this didn't get overturned on appeal, but a judge couldn't possibly say we're seizing every asset you own. It'd be like if I sue Bill Gates and I'm expecting to get a $10,000 judgment against him, but I get some wacky judge to seize every asset Bill Gates has, which is billions. Because, you know, the judge, this Daniel Hall, did not know what Alec's net worth was. He doesn't know what Buster's net worth is. He doesn't know the dollar amount of what he's seizing. And there is no settlement before him at all. They haven't even gone to trial. In fact, it would be a couple of years before they did go to trial. So it was an outrageous overreach then. But in seizing all of Alec's assets and sticking them in the receivership, Alec couldn't have made bail if it was $10. He had no access to any of his money at all. And so that's what was one of the issues in the bond reduction hearing is, in fact, the judge started to say that. She said, well, wait a minute. This other judge has seized all of your assets, and he's only presiding over one case, and it's a civil trial, and so you can't make bail, period? Well, that was true. And at that point in that bond reduction hearing, this judge did have the power to overturn Daniel Hall's appointment of the receivership. She could have said it's unconstitutionally broad. You've seized an amount of money that you don't even know what he's worth against. There's no settlement. There's no judgment against Alec. This is just unconstitutional. And she was sort of getting to that point, and she's famous for reducing bonds and setting low bonds. And then DeCarpoolian pipes up with this, we don't need to hear from the victims. They all sing the same song. And I think it pissed the judge off. And she said, I'm denying the motion to lower the bail. And so there were some weird things that went on. But right about that time, Fitz News was publishing articles about her being too lax on criminals. And they sort of had this editorial policy that anytime Alec Murdoch was about to get a fair shake or a reasonable fair shake or whatever, they made sure to publish a series of articles to whip up this frenzy that he is this evil, he's the head of this evil crime family, and he's not deserving of any breaks
and
at all.
And who was the judge?
Allison Lee, I believe, was her name.
Allison Lee.
So and it was a shock, and I think it was a shock to Alec that his bond wasn't reduced. I think he did expect at that point that if it was reduced, then a family member could help him make bond, and he would have been, you know, at least he would have been out on bail to assist in his own defense in the murder trial. Because for him to try to assist in his defense while being incarcerated was an enormous burden that no plaintiff should have to, no defendant, excuse me, should have to try to overcome at trial in a murder case. It put him at an awful disadvantage. It really did. But and this enormous bias in media was equally awful. So let's get back to this. So there's more to Patrick Wilson and Sean Connolly. Was Sean Connolly at a wedding recently that you might want to talk about?
Yeah. So he was at the wedding of Anthony Cook. So they're all starting to get married now. Morgan Daughtry just got married in October. Connor and Miley just got engaged 2 weeks ago. And Anthony got married, I think, in June or July.
Oh, this is beautiful. You know why? Because they can't testify against each other.
No, nobody's asking them to testify against each other, though. They're kind of solid.
But here's what I think is interesting about the friend group. So you have to know the friend group, right? And the friend group is Patrick Wilson, Sean Connolly, Connor Cook, Anthony Cook, Morgan Daughtry, Paul Murdoch, Mallory Beach, and Miley Altman. That is the friend group. That's the core group at towards the end of 2018, 2019. And of course, as I said, Wilson, Conley, and both the Cook boys were friends with Paul from when they were just little kids. But that's the friend groups, right? So let's take a look at all these deaths that surround this group. And they do. They surround this group. Yeah. I'm not saying these kids have something to do with any of this. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is there's a lot of deaths that involve people from this group. And let's start with number one. Number one is Stephen Smith, 2018. You've got Patrick Wilson and Sean Connolly are named persons of interest, according to an article in Fitz News, in the 2015 homicide of Stephen. Okay?
Vehicular homicide.
Miley Altman. Yeah. Miley Altman is Patrick Wilson's cousin. She's Connor Cook's now fiance. Gloria Satterfield. All right? Now you got Gloria Satterfield. According to Connor Cook and Patrick Wilson, Paula Murdoch pushed her off the steps. She's dead, 2018. Now you have Mallory Beach, 2019. She's best friends with Morgan, best friends with Miley for sure, which is Patrick's cousin. And she's killed when she's thrown from the boat that Paul Murdoch was allegedly driving. It was also alleged by many that Connor Cook was being set up to take the fall for Murdoch. So even Connor thought that after the boat crash. And he dumped his Murdoch attorney, who? Corey Fleming, because of it. So, and it's the same Murdoch attorney who represented Patrick Wilson in his attempted murder charge and the Satterfields in the wrongful death insurance scam that he and Alex stole over $4 million from. Alex and Corey, as you know, are in prison.
All right. Patrick, wait. Patrick Wilson, attempted murder charge? Oh, I think you mentioned this.
We talked about that last week.
Yeah.
It's being held in abeyance, basically. It got reduced to manslaughter or something, but they just have suspended the prosecution of the case. Yeah, assault. Okay.
Yeah.
So we got Miles. We got Mallory. Yeah.
What were the particulars? What were the particulars around that? I mean,
attempted murder.
Yeah. Did he run somebody over? Did he hang somebody from a tree? What did
he fired
do?
A gun. He fired.
He told me that somebody owed him money, and they got off the side of the road with that person, And I think there was one or two people in that person's car, and there was an argument that Wilson was arguing with. I think he told me it was about drugs or drug money type of thing. Somebody owed him money. I think it was for drugs. And then Wilson got mad at this person, and he went back to Conley's truck and got a handgun and shot the gun in the direction of the people. He didn't shoot at the people. Okay. He shot in the direction. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
But that case was sent to the 14th solicitor's office, and Corey Fleming was referred as an attorney to Patrick Wilson when Patrick and his grandmother, Lucy Altman, great-grandmother Lucy Altman, went to go visit Alec down at PMPED. That was eventually dropped, or as Elaine said, it was
held in abeyance, basically. It's just in suspension. They could still prosecute it, but it sounds like they don't have enough evidence to go forward with the case. Mm. And it's what's it called, nole whatever.
Persique. Yeah.
Okay.
Who's also dead? She's the fifth person now dead from this friend group. That was clearly Paul's mother. So he's got five people: Stephen Smith, Gloria Satterfield, Mallory Beach, Paul Murdoch, Maggie Murdoch. All the people: Wilson, Conley, Connor Cook, Anthony Cook, Morgan, Miley, and Paul are all intertwined somehow in those five deaths. I'm not saying that they did it at all. What I'm saying is their names appear in all those five deaths. As friends of, or knew of, or heard of, this type of thing. But let's go, who is in prison, right? So clearly Alex Murdoch's in prison. He's convicted of murdering Paul and Maggie by a jury that decided a six-week case in about 45 minutes. I've said many times in my book, Defending Alec Murdoch, which is available on Amazon, that it's impossible for some of the evidence that the state presented, such as Alec decides that he was at night, shooting Paul not once but twice, and then taking his 300-pound body and dropping that gun, picking up another gun, running 30 feet at an angle of 41 degrees at night with bad eyes, and dropping to a knee or shooting below his hip, and getting stippling on Maggie in a matter of 5 to 6 seconds. It just is physically impossible. What it is possible is including myself and few SLED agents that stood on the stand and said that a two-shooter scenario.
Oh, can you see me? Can you see me standing up, waving my hand?
And me too.
Two-shooter scenario, according to SLED agents, is possible, and they can't rule it out. You know who else said they couldn't rule it out? Ronnie Palmbach, who was the head of the Wisconsin State Crime Lab. Mark Garagos, world-renowned attorney. Sarah Azadi. Dr. Kenny Kenzie, for crying out loud, the key state witness. He said he couldn't rule out two shooters. And then I even interviewed a guy called Thomas Haynes, who's a retired investigator from the Nashville Medical Examiner's Office, and he said the same thing. Uh-huh. It can't be done. Period.
So how is that end not a directed verdict from Stop reasonable doubt it. Right there? Yeah. I mean, this was, I remember when Melinda Worley, I think is her name, the one that she reminds me of the character in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
Melinda, okay. And she... she sort of was a little bit pained to say, that I cannot rule out this two-shooter theory. And I'm thinking, okay, well, right there, Your Honor, we have reasonable doubt right here. We don't need to go forward. I want a directed verdict. You know, they can't find beyond reasonable doubt because there's doubt about whether there's one or two shooters.
Corey Fleming was Patrick's attorney. He was a short time Paul's attorney. He was Connor Cook's attorney.
Yes, yes, he was.
So this guy is just... Yeah. It's the M.O. of the Murdochs, call Corey. Then you've got Russell Lafitte, right? He's the former CEO of Palmetto Bank, and he was convicted for financial crimes with Alex. You've got Jerry Rivers,
say something here?
Cousin Eddie the Drugs. He was sentenced to 7 years for drug distribution, money laundering, and fraud surrounding Alex Murdoch. Spencer Roberts was sentenced to 8 years for money laundering and fraud with additional charges in drug distribution. And... he's part of cashing checks for Murdoch schemes. And Cousin Eddie, who was indicted in 2021 on serious charges, including drug distribution, money laundering, and his role in the staged roadside shooting and insurance scam. But he has been released from electronic. He has been released from electronic home monitoring, as I just wrote an article about this on Crime and Cat. And he has not stepped foot in a court of law to account for any of these charges in years. So what am I trying to say here? What I'm trying to say is Alex Murdaugh, Corey Fleming, Russell Lafitte, Jerry Rivers, Spencer Roberts, and Cousin Eddie have nothing to do with Stephen Smith, maybe Gloria Satterfield, but nothing, Mallory Beach and Paul or Maggie Murdaugh have nothing to do with those deaths. And the people who I said were tied to this somehow are all millionaires and are all getting married, living life and going on. I just find that very interesting.
I don't know that they're millionaires. I don't think they got millions. I think they got hundreds of thousands. So there's a difference between a million and hundreds of thousands. But, something else, though, Jim, I want to give you more credit than anybody else ever would. You point out that with Trump's election, incoming presidents typically ask U.S. attorneys to hand in the resignation because they want to appoint their own U.S. attorneys. And so this is just something that's routinely done. So so the U.S. attorneys that have led the federal prosecution of Alex are going to be replaced. And this incoming, these U.S. attorneys will not necessarily have the same political motivation to go after Alex with such ferocity. I mean, 40 years for financial crimes where the victims were, in fact, made whole seems excessive in the context of this attorney that stole $30 million and nobody was made whole and she got 5 years probation. So I think that a revisiting of the sentencing of Alex Murdaugh would certainly be appropriate. And I think that these new U.S. attorneys may say, we don't want to waste money this way, this bizarre media.
Yeah, because you have Donald Trump, who's now going to be president in January, and he is going to come in with some serious cost-cutting measures, which is DOGE thing, not to get political at all, but that's what they're going to do. They're going to cut. And the DOJ is going to have funds cut. I guarantee you the DOJ is going to have funds cut. And if Matt Gaetz gets in there, is this group really going to want to go spend money on putting the guy back in prison? Not to mention the fact Gergel has got a lot of Judge Gergel, who sentenced Russell Lafitte, and he was the judge that oversaw the case, had this case overturned by three people up in Richmond, Virginia, so three judges in the appeals court.
And the Russell Lafitte case was overturned based on basically a form of jury tampering, which is a denial of a Sixth Amendment rights. So I think that there's a lot of reason to think not only will Alec get a second trial on the murders, and I don't believe there's enough evidence to convict him, absent the hysteria and the... As much as I love Mark Tinsley, I think that the prosecution should not allow him near this second trial. I don't think they will, actually. But I don't think there's enough to convict. I don't think there's enough evidence to convict Alec Murdaugh of the murder of Paul and Meg.
Yeah, they may just give him time served, or they may
on
not
the financial
say nolle per sequi, or they might just put a plea agreement together to avoid the complexities of a retrial, and time served, and he's done. Type of thing, but he's not going to be able to be.
It's going to be a different. It's a different climate and a different set of motivations for the prosecutors. And I don't believe the hysteria whipped up by Netflix made a lot of money. A lot of people made a lot of money marketing this evil Alec Murdaugh empire narrative. It was very appealing. People loved it. They were fascinated by it. I don't think they were fascinated by it at all. And I think that the second trial will be entirely different. There'll be less motivation. And
can anybody really verbalize the true thing that in the murder trial, Alex Murdaugh was convicted of?
No.
What was he convicted of? He was convicted of being...
We want to get a cigarette and we want to be able to get home early.
No. Here's a member of the elite class that abused the system and we're jealous of the lifestyle. Look at the jurors. Look at the socioeconomical makeup of the jurors. And this is the rich guy, right, that lives this lifestyle, has been screwing us because they brought the, what do you call it? They brought the financial stuff in. And you know what? We don't like him. Let's punish him forever.
Well, here's what I can tell you for a fact. For a fact, Myra Crossley was sitting on that jury. For a fact, she sat outside with jurors multiple times during the day as they would take smoke breaks and would listen to them talk about the Murdaugh trial. And a fact, according to Myra, up until the financial crimes, everybody said Alex was not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. They thought that the prosecution and the state was wasting their time.
So my supposition holds some water?
Yes. After the financial crimes, they spent a week boring everybody to death about the financial crimes. Myra said it was immediately after that week that all of a sudden everybody was like, oh, my God, yeah, he killed him. And she was like, wait a minute. Just a week ago, you're saying he's not guilty. And then she said, well, then they would say, well, then if he can do that to those people, then, yeah, he can do that to his wife and his son. And, you know, she would just roll her eyes and be like, okay, whatever. And if he gets a new trial, which I do believe he will, if he gets a new trial, those financial crimes are going to find them nowhere near that. They will not be introduced.
Well, they're not going to be that important. The jury's already heard it. I can't believe the jury wasn't aware of those financial crimes because the media had covered them so thoroughly. We knew exactly what those indictments were and what was alleged, and we knew that the people had been made whole. And I don't think another judge would allow them in. They're irrelevant. They're highly prejudicial. We know they're highly prejudicial, and they're not relevant to – it's ridiculous to say that they're relevant to motivation. Yeah, I wanted to deflect attention by brutally killing my son and my wife. And by the way, in doing that, I'm making – you know, I make sure that – what? That I'm –
from Jeannie Secretary, who seized – who's had millions of dollars slip through her fingers over the past 10 years. I'm worried about her. No, I'm not worried about her. Am I worried about the boat crash case and Mark Tinsley?
No.
Well, I can tell you for a fact that Alec Murdaugh didn't even call his attorney in that particular case the day of the murders. Didn't even call his attorney. In fact, he was supposed to go to the office to go get those financial documents. He didn't get to the office till about 11 o'clock in the morning. He was in no hurry whatsoever. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. What is a bigger motive to murder? What is a bigger motive? To stay out of prison? So I'm going to go murder somebody to make sure I don't go to prison, shut them up for good, or because Jeannie Secretary might find a couple hundred thousand dollars if she's not sure where.
Yeah, I agree. And what? And he owns the firm. And by the way, the money she was going to find is money. It was his money. It was money that would come to him after the first of the year. It was his fees for this case. What he's doing is just taking his fee 5 months early, basically 6 months early. Is it kosher? No. Is he the only partner in a law firm ever to do that? I highly doubt it. In fact, my very first attorney got disbarred for doing what Alec did. But she didn't go to jail, and nobody accused her of murder, and it wasn't considered motive.
Anyway, that's my whole point of, you know, listen.
I agree.
If Paul was murdered to shut him up for good because my son was in a boat crash, this is about the boat crash. I think it was about the boat crash, but I also think
I do too.
It was to avenge Mallory, but also the bigger thing is when you take Mallory, it's not so much to kill Paul Murdaugh for Mallory, but when you take Mallory and you add it in with knowledge that Paul may have had about Stephen Smith and who was the real killer of Stephen Smith, and I don't know who is, but who the real killer of Stephen Smith is, and he knew.
Because, you know, we're talking about this, that the Patrick Wilson is saying that Paul bragged about being responsible for Gloria Satterfield's death, but wasn't Paul probably aware of who actually was driving the vehicle that hit Stephen Smith and was therefore responsible for his death? Isn't that possibly...
You and I interviewed a person.
Yes.
We won't name who he is.
An investigator, a credible investigator, a former DEA agent, highly credentialed investigator who looked into this.
Yes. You go ahead and say...
That Paul and Buster weren't even in the county the night that Stephen was killed, and that your two, these people named in the mate report, were likely responsible for the hit-and-run death of Stephen Smith, is what he said.
But what did he say? People told him what Conley said at parties. What did Conley say at parties, according to this source?
That he was responsible. Yeah.
So my point is, these kids who all hung out together in the friend group, they all knew, whether they all thought that they were BSing each other or they were just embellishing or whatever it was, or maybe they thought it was true and he's drunk and whatever. Who knows, right? Who knows? But the fact is, so many people have said, Paul said he did this to Gloria. Maybe he did it to, yep. Maybe it never happened, but maybe he's saying that because Gloria's dead and who cares. But he, you know, trying to make himself look bigger. You know, he was only 5'7", and maybe he was just trying to make himself look bigger. Same thing with Conley. You know, Conley was trying to get maybe street cred. Who knows? But that's, I'm not saying Conley said that. What I'm saying is our source, believe
a credible source
person,
yes,
that told him that, that they heard.
And by the way, this credible source was working for one of the most credible attorneys, Andy Savage, one of the most credible attorneys that South Carolina has ever had. You know, so this wasn't some fly-by-night attorney or fly-by-night investigator. And so
I ask you again to take a look at the people who are in prison and then take a look at the people who are dead and who is closely intertwined with the people who are dead and who is not.
You mean we can't pin this on the Clintons? We can't,
I like the way you're waiting for them.
We can't pin this on the Clintons.
I don't think we can pin it on Alec Murdoch, frankly. I do think if we work at it, we could pin it on what? Trump?
Listen, let me tell you something. You know what the lesson to be learned here is? This goes on in the Lowcountry. This goes on in Arkansas. This goes on in Northern California. I mean, this goes on everywhere. This goes on everywhere.
I know, but here's the thing, Frank. You know, you're in Colleton County, and you know Hampton is your near neighbor. Out of these two counties, which are relatively small, and I mean no offense to anybody that lives down in Colleton or Hampton, my question is, if you're in some of those two smallest counties in the state, but, geez, it just seems like so much trouble is coming out of those two counties.
Oh, bull. Oh, bull. Go to Ridgeland County.
I'm not saying that you guys are the worst.
No. What I'm saying is,
the size of the county, there's a lot of violence out there. And what I found in this investigation.
You mean the per capita? You're saying per capita?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about that.
Hold on. There's a tremendous amount of drugs flowing through Colleton and Hampton. Not only Colleton and Hampton, but towns that are located along I-95.
Well, I-95 is the issue. I-95.
Yeah, it's a major drug corridor.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah,
but you guys are a major drug corridor because you have that incoming,
And you want to know? You want to know? I'll tell you what the I'll tell you what the alternate route is. 17 and 17A. You know, we have 17 and 17A runs right through Cottageville, and they're both north south, and they both start and terminate at exits along I-95. If I-95 is hot, man, they come up these other roads, and
I will tell you the other bombshell. Since we're talking about drugs, the other bombshell that Patrick Wilson dropped on me: police corruption in Hampton County.
All right, let's hold that for the next episode, and you can decide between now and when we record the next episode, and how much you want to be discreet about, because I. No. And I'm very serious here.
I'm not going to name names. I'm
all right.
Even though I have but there the names are, to the people that he told me. I'm
yeah.
Not name names
I mean, this can be. I mean, you know, you might have to. I have to live here, and you have to travel through the county occasionally. Elaine is okay. She's up there with those crazy politicians.
I'm saying is, this is what Wilson told me.
All right.
Believe it or not. This is what I'm telling you.
Maybe they'll get rid of Wilson and leave you and I alone. All right, listen.
This was not firsthand information he heard from somebody. This was eyewitness. He saw it.
All right. Now we're at this an hour. That's a good place to leave off. I'm gonna mail order a threat level 2 bulletproof vest. And you know, you can buy them on Amazon. So I can hide in an interior room till it comes. All right,
Frank,
you guys.
Actually, I'm going to need, after what happened today, I'm going to need some glasses with one of those noses like Jimmy Durante,
disguise?
Yeah. You think it'll work?
Yeah, I'm sure it will. All right, guys, listen, we have, I wrote down where we left off. All right.
Oh, good.
Jim, and we're going to hold your feet to the fire.
Folks, I thank you too much. Not only is this incredibly informative, not only is this a shocker, it's a lot of fun. And I thank you very much. And you're listening to WVFF 97.7 Red Brick Patriot Radio, broadcasting from Cottageville, South Carolina. And you have been listening to True Crime in the Lowcountry with Elaine Greenwood of Super Woke News and Jim Kask of Crime and Kask. And Elaine, we're out of here. Talk to you folks next week.
Yes, we are.
All righty. Bye-bye.
See you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Love you guys. Bye.
Bye.
And that's all the time we have for now on True Crime in the Lowcountry. We hope you've enjoyed our in-depth coverage of the Murdaugh murder trial so far. Don't worry, we'll be back soon to dive even deeper into the case and bring you more chilling stories from the Lowcountry region. We thank you for listening to Veterans for Freedom Radio, the Truth in Broadcasting Corporation.